The work of this church in the world is realized through the generous financial support of all who call this place home. Along with the gifts and time and talent, ours is a shared ministry. You have a role to play here. Church membership is open to all. For more information, go to uusf.org.
Our reading this morning is from the poet Joy Harjo, citizen of the Muskogee Nation and 23rd Poet Laureate of the United States, a poem entitled, "Perhaps the World Ends Here." The world begins at a kitchen table. No matter what, we must eat to live. The gifts of Earth are brought and prepared, set on the table. So it has been since creation, and it will go on. We chase chickens and dogs away from it. Babies teethe at the corners. They scrape their knees under it. It's here that children are given instructions on what it means to be human. We make men at it. We make women at it. At this table, we gossip, recall enemies, and the ghosts of lovers. Our dreams drink coffee with us as they put their arms around our children. They laugh with us at our poor falling down selves, and we put ourselves back together once again at the table. This table has been a house in the rain, an umbrella in the sun. Wars have begun and ended at this table. It is a place to hide in the shadows of terror, a place to celebrate the terrible victory. We have given birth at this table. We have prepared our parents for burial at this table. At this table, we sing with joy, with sorrow. We pray of suffering and remorse. We give thanks. Perhaps the world will end at the kitchen table while we are laughing and crying, eating of the last sweet bite. Some of my daughter's earliest lessons about what it means to be in relationship, to be in community, to be part of a family took place around the dining room table. I'd heard before she was born that you could teach a child sign language before they could learn to speak, and it would ease their frustration and allow you to communicate need and nuance. So when she was about 6 months old, I started trying to teach her a few words, myself and her. The author who advocated for sign language to be taught to small children and wrote the book that we parents were using, he suggested that you teach first the word for hurt or pain and where. Mostly because that's the only way he knew once that his kid had a bunch of beans in her ear. She cried, and he said, "Hurt?" And she said, "Yes." And he said, "Where?" And she pointed to her ear, and the doctor found a treasure trove inside. For some reason, though, I decided not to do that. I went straight to please and thank you and more. Ones that were practical, about growing up and connected, respectful, engaged relationship. I also apparently taught my daughter some signs inadvertently, one of which I learned one day while she was eating her meal, and I asked, "More? Do you want more, Lila?" And she did this. And I knew she was finished, and I knew we had made up our own sign. Enough is different in official ASL. She also taught me that she was early on learning the nuance of language when one day, and she was in a particularly sort of fussy mood, I said, "Say please, Lila, say please. Lila, say please." She stiffened her little back and went like this. I think that means something other than please. Language, connection, graciousness, or the lack thereof, a desire for clarity and mutual understanding all started at the table, as young as we could begin in our family. I'm sure you all know now the studies summarized in an abstract from the National Library of Medicine about family meals, that, quote, frequent family meals are inversely associated with disordered eating, alcohol and substance use, violent behavior and feelings of depression or thoughts of suicide in adolescence. There is a positive relationship between frequent family meals and increased self-esteem and school success. Just sitting around the table, eating, being together, whatever happens around those tables means that kids are less likely to do any number of things that put their future and their well-being in jeopardy. We learn so much around the tables. Not just how to use a fork and knife or chopsticks. We learn things we didn't even intend to teach. We do it by osmosis, almost, we human beings. The world begins at the kitchen table, writes the poet Joy Harjo. No matter what, we must eat to live. The gifts of the earth are bought and prepared and set on the table, and so it has been since creation, and it will go on. We chase chickens and dogs away from it. Babies teethe at the corners. They scrape their knees under it. It's here that children are given instructions on what it means to be human. We make men at it. We make women. The poet is right. We do make people at these tables, don't we? It isn't simple to prepare a meal. Less simple if you're Daniel with his friends preparing for an entire co-op of 50. But making a meal is a place where we meet in shared purpose. The making of it has always, through time, united us in work that is clear and clean. These are the places, as Naomi Raplansky writes, where, quote, the work of the world, common as mud, end quote, has to be done when the crops need to come in or the fire be put out, where we pass the bags along or the buckets of water along in a line, all of it like meal prep, where we peel the potatoes and we set out the china and the glasses and we pour the water in this array of ancient, timeless rituals that are not of church, but of everyday life. They are the original rituals of communion, carried out by lay worship associates in a billion dining rooms. All these acts of labor and love, of plant and animal life and our own time given over, sacrificed to feed one another, body and spirit. For another day of making it through, another day given to weaving the world a little more whole and connected, like the children and the teenagers who sitting there will be a little less likely for having sat there and been fed at these tables to risk what is their inheritance, this gift of life. We talk about how divided the world is. We feel it, especially, I think, a lot of us right now. And in the face of it, it's interesting and important to remember how easy it actually is to stay connected. Indeed, one of the things that we learn around the tables is how interconnected we are, all of us. Not just in the making of the meal and working together are we connected. And in the food that we serve that connects us to earth and to all the distant places and hands and water that nurtured and harvested it. And if that didn't do enough to cement our interconnection, then the stories we tell around the table will do the rest. At this table, we gossip, the poet writes. We recall enemies and the ghosts of lovers. Our dreams drink coffee with us as they put their arms around our children, she writes. They laugh with us at our poor, falling down selves as we put ourselves back together once again at the table. Oh, those stories of ghosts and enemies. You know the stories. Your family, I bet, has its own, and your group of friends. Church has its own set too. All those stories that get told at the tables we will sit at once again in the weeks ahead. The stories about a set of rogues and saints and wild characters and quiet, enduring lives, and all of them how they are invited to shape our own sense of ourselves. I think those stories that we hear that connect us back through time to people who have come before, who are in our family or in our circles or in our communities, in our shared history, these, maybe more than all the sacred books of religion with the stories told there, remind us of how we're interconnected to the larger story of humanity, but also have this subtle invitation to ask how we're going to weave our story into it, into the saga of human family. I sat this week on Thursday with Mary Jane Micaria. Mary Jane, are you here? Oh, there she is. And Andre, her grandson, who's going to win Grandson of the Year award because he drove her today when I told her that I was going to be repeating with permission some stories that she shared. Mary Jane, and you won't believe it now, Mary Jane, I'm sorry, but everyone's going to look at you during coffee hour. Mary Jane is in her 90s, which is like astoundingly unbelievable, which just goes to show you all if you're wondering why to go to church, because church makes you look young for a very, very long time, apparently. Mary Jane's mother, Anna Schwenk, immigrated as a 2-year-old with her parents from Austria-Hungary. Her mother met and married a man who came to this country to do graduate studies in engineering. Tadafumi Micaria was Japanese from a samurai family. And the two of them met in the late 1920s at an international gathering of students at the University of Pennsylvania that was an alternative to the official International House and its meetings because that center wouldn't allow Black Americans to join. Mary Jane's mother, just so you know, this incredible history, had previously lost her scholarship to medical school. Imagine a woman in the 20s going to medical school, lost her scholarship when the Christian women's group that gave the scholarship discovered that this recipient had helped integrate the spring tea at Oberlin College, holding with 2 other students the school accountable for its founding commitment to both women and Blacks being admitted and admitted as equals to the school. When Mary Jane's mother's and father's families both objected to this union, Anna talked it over with a woman she called her American mother, Mary Jane Kerr. Ms. Kerr was fierce in her free thinking and commitment to principle. She was an activist in the 1920s and before for a woman's right to vote, and she passed this incredible strong sense of self and obligation to Mary Jane's mother. She is the reason, in fact, that Anna applied to Oberlin in particular and to medical school. And in this moment of choice, when approached by Anna, Mary Jane Kerr said, "You don't choose someone to marry for their race. You choose them based on values and character. And Tada Fumi seems like a man who has great character and values." Mary Jane Mikuria, the second child from this marriage and the first girl, would be named for this woman, who was one of the few who cheered on this couple toward the altar for this incredibly visionary, aligned, difficult life as a couple in the United States, which wasn't completely ready to receive them. And Mary Jane told me all of this at a table set with tea and cookies. So much of what we tell of our ghosts and our lovers, of our lives courageous and grace-filled, of lives before us that were inspired and inspiring and heartbreaking and gorgeous, we learn at the table. And one person's story reminds us of how we are interconnected into all stories and all possibilities, and how we might write our own from those choices. And it is all told and given to us by osmosis at the table. So much happens at the table. And there is one other thing that I've been thinking about lately that we also learn at the table of our lives that feels super relevant right now. So let me name it before we go out into our days. And that is how to be in relationship to difference. The folks we gather with at the tables of our lives are people we are connected to in some ways, but not always people we see eye to eye with. Are there any amens in the field out there today? I know that many of you at this time of year, in particular through the December holidays, you will be back in the mix of gatherings, accepting and going to them or choosing not to, where there has been the experience of hurt or anger or difficulty. And I want to acknowledge the truth that we don't always find a way to reconciliation with the people around these tables. And that sometimes we can't, in good faith, sit at them anymore. And how other times we will go out of a larger sense of duty to the connections that we find there. Sarah Schulman, who's a professor and a writer who's contributed greatly to LGBT studies in her work, she writes in her book, "Conflict is Not Abuse," which I am making my way through, that, quote, "The values required for social repair are the same values required for personal repair. And so this discussion of repair must begin in micro experience." She writes, "In order to protect ourselves, we could actually be hurting ourselves if we're missing out on transformative experiences of the heart and sabotaging our small but crucial contribution to making peace." Heaven knows there is a lot of discernment about what situations we choose to be in and whether those are places we will make our contribution to peace. But I am sitting these days with what she's written and what we can learn around the table and practice there too, this piece of it, and how much the world needs social repair and where it does start. And so to all of you who are going to be in places where there is hard difference and there is pain, in these weeks ahead, I want to send you with blessings of grace and love and small protective spells, though I am not a magician, but I wish I were, but I send you those small protective blessings or spells and the hope that something beautiful and healing can break through. The world will need our small acts of courage as much as our big ones. Wars have begun and ended at this table, the poet Joy Harjo writes. It's a place to hide in the shadow of terror, a place to celebrate the terrible victory. We have given birth on this table, and we have prepared our parents for burial here. At this table, we sing with joy, with sorrow. We pray of suffering and remorse, and we give thanks. So, as you and I take stock of the harvests of our lives and all we've been given, and as we meditate on the seeds of what we want to sow into the ground for the next year's tending, let us offer a prayer of intention that we find the best we can in and among us as we break bread in the week ahead. That we remember all the ways we practice what it means to be human in the fullest, richest sense at the tables of our lives. That we tell stories and soak them in and feel the interconnection that is always there among us, but in our bones that we know it, and we let the food nourish us, and we let the company nourish us, and we give thanks for the messy, gorgeous, complicated feasts that meet us from birth to death at these tables. Perhaps the world will end at the kitchen table, the poet writes, while we are laughing and crying, eating of the last sweet bite. Blessings to us all and to each last sweet bite. Amen.
In college, I lived 1 year in a student cooperative house. The 50 of us took care of all of our own needs, buying groceries, cooking meals, cleaning the kitchen and bathrooms. I liked to cook, so I was excited when one of the jobs that I was assigned was cooking dinner as part of a team of four. Going in, I was mostly excited about the food aspect. I could ensure that at least the one dinner of the week that I was involved in would have good vegetarian food. I was also excited to use our industrial kitchen. Much like the big kitchen here at UUSF, it featured 10 burners, 2 large ovens, 4 sinks, and a stand mixer big enough to knead at least 4 loaves of bread at once. My ego also liked the idea of planning the menu, making a particularly delicious meal, and having all of my housemates praise how well dinner came out. What I hadn't expected was the social aspect. It turns out that spending 3 hours a week with the same people all quarter means you get to know them pretty well. If I'm chopping onions for half an hour because we've scaled up a recipe tenfold, it's easy to chat while you do that. Though that probably contributed to the number of times that I cut myself. Beyond the conversations that we had while cooking, you just learn a lot about people by cooking with them, as many of you probably know from the winter shelter and other events. We did our best to have fun and stay relaxed, but when it comes down to it, cooking for 50 people is pretty intense. If you run late, your hungry house gets antsy, and if you do a bad job, Your housemates grudgingly smile through a meal that you know is not good. I learned that one of my housemates gets very snippy when they're stressed that their meal isn't turning out as they planned. Another needed to be told exactly what to do. They weren't a proactive member of the team. But for the most part, the challenges brought out the best in us. If a dish was burned or over-seasoned or running late, we would problem solve together and find creative ways to put out a pretty good meal. Our cultural backgrounds showed up too. I still remember when one of my teammates, who was from Texas, told me that he wanted to make ribs. He was excited enough that he was willing to start cooking a whole hour early on his own, since they needed to roast low and slow. I'm pretty sure he skipped a class to do this. Despite his best efforts, the ribs finished about half an hour late, but the meat eaters really did like them. Many of the best meals were when people cooked food that they grew up eating, which included curry, enchiladas, dumplings, pho, and grits. In that kitchen, we didn't just make meals for our community, we also made memories. So good luck to all of you who are cooking this week. May you make many happy memories.